The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service. And for the next hour, I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit G. Suggs Insurance. That's GSUGGSinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Today's Time Magazine edition is dated May 10/May 17, 2021. The heading says 100 Most Influential Companies, and this is all within the usual bright red border around the front cover. It frames today a photograph of a man standing in front of a basketball. The man is dressed in a very dapper gray windowpane check suit with a white shirt and a navy blue tie. He has his hands almost folded in front of his chest, but not quite, because his left hand is adjusting a cufflink on his right wrist. He is bald. He's looking directly at the camera lens. He has bright brown eyes. He wears glasses. He's neither smiling nor frowning. He has just a bit of a pleasant look on his face. This is Commissioner Adam Silver of the NBA, who is playing to win. For the record, a cluster here of short items. Honestly, a bunch of people probably will die in the beginning. It's tough sledding over there. That was stated by Elon Musk in an April 22 interview about his company's plan to send humans to Mars. I cannot find any justification for how I was treated, so I have to conclude that it happened because I'm a woman. Ursula von der Leyen, European Commission President, speaking on April 26 about being denied a chair while meeting Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan earlier in the month. He will always be present, Miguel Diaz-Canel, President of Cuba, lauding Raul Castro in an April 19 speech in which Diaz-Canel accepted the position of First Secretary in Cuba's Communist Party, which Castro retired from days earlier. My mom met my dad. They had sex. It's amazing. Daniel Kaluuya. In an April 25 speech at the 2021 Oscars, accepting the Best Supporting Actor Award for his role in Judas and the Black Messiah. In the audience, Kaluuya's mother could be seen asking, "What is he talking about?" in response. Four times in a row is too much. Jukka Lindström, Finnish comedian, speaking with the New York Times April 20 about the recently released 2021 World Happiness Report, which has since 2018 consistently ranked Finland as the world's happiest country. 60 million, that's 60 million, number of doses of the AstraZeneca COVID-19 vaccine the U.S. will share with countries around the world, according to the White House, April 26. 40, 40. Number of days 15 volunteers spent in a cave in France without clocks or light before emerging, April 24, as part of an experiment monitoring the brain's perceptions of time in isolated environments. And good news of the week, the State Department authorized U.S. embassies around the world to fly the Pride flag, rolling back a Trump administration rule in a diplomatic cable reported April 22. The brief opener, one page here of this article, The Presidency, Biden's Bet on Big Government, by Alana Abramson and Brian Bennett. President Joe Biden was huddling with aides in the Oval Office in late April, preparing for a Zoom tour of Proterra, an electric bus and battery plant in Greenville, South Carolina. The company does the kind of eco-friendly manufacturing that Biden hopes will balloon if Congress passes his $2 trillion infrastructure proposal, which includes nearly $80 billion in federal investment in these types of clean energy jobs. Biden was blunt about the larger goal. This is how we show people that the government has a role to play, he said before getting on the call. That vision of government has been at the heart of Biden's first 100 days in office. He has pumped nearly $1.9 trillion into the economy, more than any other president at this point in a first term, through a stimulus bill that offers everything from rental assistance to vaccine distribution. Biden has laid out plans for an additional $2 trillion to create millions of jobs while redefining infrastructure, and $1.8 trillion for education and paid leave, paid for largely through tax increases on the wealthy. If all become law, the three initiatives will constitute the biggest federal investment in the middle and lower classes since President Lyndon B. Johnson's Great Society. Biden's making a $6 trillion bet. He has calculated, aides say, that the twin shocks of the past 4 years, President Donald Trump's gutting of the federal government and a historic pandemic, have created a once-in-a-career opportunity. By embracing a pre-Reagan vision of expansive government that delivers for a hurting nation, he hopes to capitalize on the post-Trump political movement. It is comparable to the Great Depression and World War II, where there were massive emergencies that affected everyone, and people were very, very responsive to a major government role, says Celinda Lake, a Democratic pollster who advised Biden's campaign. So far, Biden's bet seems to be paying off. His approval rating has hovered in the mid-50s, according to Gallup, modest by historical standards, but strong in the acutely polarized political climate. Trump never cracked 50%. Some 46% of Americans say the country's headed in the right direction, according to a Monmouth University poll released April 14, the highest number in 8 years. But even Biden's allies acknowledge that goodwill is tenuous. The country remains deeply divided. Biden has a narrow, fragile majority in Congress, and holding together progressives and moderates in his party is already proving hard. Republicans are eager to make it harder, seizing on crises like the surge of unaccompanied migrant children at the U.S.-Mexico border to attack him and to dampen his approval ratings. With midterms 18 months away and the Democrats facing challenges on multiple fronts, Biden has little time to get his ambitious agenda enacted. That he is pursuing it at all is a surprise for a man who was a middle-of-the-road Democrat for most of his 35-year career in the U.S. Senate. I really kind of thought he would be much more of a traditionalist, says Representative Jim Clyburn, the House Majority Whip who gave Biden a critical endorsement during the campaign, though I am very pleased and excited. Allies say Biden's shift is partly a function of his new role. The Senate requires compromise, while the presidency offers greater unilateral power. It's also true the country has changed. For much of Biden's Senate career, politics demanded a commitment, in principle at least, to minimizing the government's role and limiting spending. Biden has concluded that what voters want above all else is for the government to deliver. In 2015, Pew Research found 68% of Democrats and 23% of Republicans said the government should do more to solve problems. By September 2020, those numbers had increased to 82% of Democrats and 32% of Republicans. If Biden's first 100 days were all about getting shots in arms and cash into people's wallets, his next 100 will be more complicated. Biden aims to pass both the $2 trillion American Jobs Plan and the $1.8 trillion American Families Plan by the end of the year. He pitched the latter plan in his first address to Congress, April 28, pledging to work across the aisle. Fights among Democrats may prove just as challenging. Already, Biden's party is squabbling over whether to include a tax break that mostly benefits northeastern states, just one of the friction points he will have to grease to get a bill passed on party lines. So far, Biden's been helped by circumstance. The Trump administration ordered the bulk of the vaccine shots Biden inherited and distributed. He's also benefited from an opposition party with few unifying principles beyond fealty to an unpopular former president. That has left room for Biden to evangelize for government solutions wherever he can. As he told an executive at Proterra, the South Carolina company building electric school buses and city buses, "We have a lot of catching up to do, but we are going to be in a position where we ought to own the future here." For Biden, success may come down to how much he and the American public are willing to pay for it. On the next page, there's a photo. Now, it looks to me like blotchy, sunburned skin. There are kind of some white splotches on a not quite red, not quite tan, but certainly more deeply flesh-colored than a sunburned skin. The caption reads, "Red Planet." The Martian helicopter, known as Ingenuity, flew 300 million miles to fly 17 feet. The longer journey was the trip it made from Earth to Mars, tucked inside NASA's Perseverance rover. The shorter trip came as Ingenuity made its second flight on the planet, remaining airborne for 51.9 seconds, April 22, and climbing to its peak, 17 feet altitude. It was then it took this aerial photo, with one of its landing pads visible on the upper left and its shadow on the rusty red ground below. Indeed, there is what looks like a little black knob on the left side of this photo. That's one of its landing pads. And at the bottom, it actually looks like a bug. It looks like some kind of a little stick-type black bug with two antennae. And that's its shadow on what is called the rusty red ground. Under the caption, "World," this short article is written by Madeline Roach. U.S. formally acknowledges Armenian genocide. In what many view as a long overdue step in reckoning with history, President Joe Biden declared April 24 that the mass killings of Armenians by Ottoman forces during World War I constituted genocide. "We do this not to cast blame, but to ensure that what happened is never repeated," Biden said in a statement on Armenian Genocide Remembrance Day, marking the first time the U.S. has formally deemed the killings genocide. At least 30 other countries, including France and Canada, have also formally recognized the genocide. Other U.S. allies, such as the U.K. and Israel, have not. Atrocities during World War I, the Germany-aligned Ottoman Empire accused Armenians of treachery. after suffering a heavy defeat at the hands of Russian forces. 1.5 million Armenians were later killed in massacres or in forced marches through the Syrian desert that resulted in many starving to death. About 500,000 Armenians survived, many immigrating to Russia, the U.S., and elsewhere. Turkey, the modern-day state built on the ruins of the Ottomans, acknowledges that atrocities occurred during that period, but denies they constituted genocide. Reactions. Biden's announcement has given Mary Kouyoumidian, an Armenian-American composer based in New York, renewed faith in the president's commitment to human rights, she says, adding that many Armenian-American families still experience survivor guilt. But she believes the wounds of the past will not fully heal until Turkey acknowledges the genocide. The Turkish government said Biden's statement opened a wound in relations between the two NATO allies and has deeply injured the Turkish people. Another war. Simon Magakian, an Armenian-American lecturer in international relations at the University of Colorado, says the U.S. is recognizing the Armenian genocide only truly matters if the White House takes measures to help protect the security of Armenians, including in Nagorno-Karabakh, a disputed region over which Armenia and Azerbaijan recently went to war. The conflict saw at least 6,000 Armenian and Azerbaijani soldiers killed and 40,000 Karabakh Armenians displaced. Recognizing Armenia's past without its present is not meaningful, he says. News ticker, three very short articles here. Rights group accuses Israel of apartheid. Human Rights Watch published a report April 27 accusing Israeli officials of committing crimes against humanity of apartheid and persecution on the basis of its treatment of Palestinians. Israeli officials have fiercely rejected the International Rights Watchdog's claims. Bolsonaro faces COVID-19 inquiry. Brazil's Congress launched an inquiry, April 27, into the government's response to the coronavirus pandemic. One likely focus is President Jair Bolsonaro, who's criticized lockdowns, masks, and vaccinations. Nearly 400,000 Brazilians have died during the pandemic. California to vote on recalling Gov, that's G-O-V, a Republican-led petition to recall Democratic California Governor Gavin Newsom has received 1.6 million signatures, officials confirmed April 26, enough to trigger a special election, expected to take place in the fall. Reality TV star Caitlyn Jenner is among those challenging Newsom. The brief news here, good question. Will Japan's low vaccination rate be an Olympic problem? And good question is in print. I didn't just make that up. This little article is by Charlie Campbell, Shanghai. With fewer than 100 days to go before the Tokyo Olympics begin July 23, the torch relay is crisscrossing Japan. But far from building excitement for the 2020 Games, the flame is sparking anxiety about holding an international event amid the pandemic. Torch runners are being heckled by protesters who want the Olympics canceled. It does not help, of course, that Japan's in the middle of a fourth COVID-19 wave. Tokyo, Kyoto, and two other regions declared states of emergency April 23 as daily cases surged above 4,500 nationwide. Fears are compounded by a vaccination rate of less than 2% across Japan's population, which is the world's oldest, with 28% of Japanese ages 65 or older. Despite foreign fans being banned and testing requirements in place for athletes and officials, the potential for the Olympics to be a super spreader event is not lost on anyone. The reasons for Japan's low immunization rate are complex, but reflected across the Asia-Pacific region, where many of the nations that controlled COVID-19 best are now falling behind in the vaccine race, potentially undoing early gains in the pandemic and stalling economic recoveries. New Zealand has fewer than 3% of its people vaccinated. South Korea and Indonesia fare a little better with fewer than 5%. Problems with some jabs have also spurred vaccine hesitancy across the region. The AstraZeneca vaccine, for example, was briefly suspended in Indonesia and Thailand because of the very rare occurrence of blood clots. In Japan, an extremely conservative attitude toward vaccine approval compounds the problem. The government has agreed to buy 314 million vaccine doses from Pfizer, AstraZeneca, and Moderna, enough for the entire population. But only the Pfizer vaccine has so far received authorization, and there will not be enough doses to cover everyone until the end of September. The government's very cautious and cannot proceed as quickly as people want, says Mieko Nakabayashi, a professor at Waseda University's School of Social Sciences in Tokyo and a former lawmaker. As the games loom, Japan's sluggish rollout also means it will be difficult to insist visiting athletes and officials get vaccinated. Draft COVID-19 protocols for the Olympics currently rely on frequent testing and isolation bubbles, but not vaccines or strict quarantines. International Olympic Committee President Thomas Bach is due to travel to Tokyo in mid-May to assess preparations. But if the games do proceed as scheduled, it seems likely the athletes will not be getting the warmest of welcomes. Nakabayashi, the ex-politician, says a close friend of hers, chosen to be an Olympic torchbearer, was among those verbally abused during the relay. "People are very nervous," she says. More brief news, a trio of short news ticker items. Investigators raid Giuliani's NYC home. Federal investigators executed a warrant to search the Manhattan apartment and office of former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani, April 28. The search reportedly was part of a probe into whether he violated lobbying laws while serving as President Trump's personal lawyer. Navalny's opposition group banned. On April 24, Russia suspended the activities of jailed opposition leader Alexei Navalny's Anti-Corruption Foundation, banning the group from posting online, organizing protests, or having access to its bank account. Its members have been arrested and forced to leave Russia. 2020 census numbers shift House seats. According to the U.S. Census Bureau, 331 million people now live in the U.S. Census data released April 26 also revealed population shifts away from the Northeast will give six states new congressional seats, including two for Texas, while seven states will each lose a seat. Three more paragraphs under this heading, Nature Bugging Out. Well, actually, there are four short paragraphs. Billions of brood X cicadas are expected to emerge across the eastern U.S. over the coming weeks, having last swarmed the U.S. in 2004. Much of America's cultural landscape has changed during the 17 years they spent underground feeding, but the world they find will not be wholly unfamiliar, to wit. And this is by Madeline Carlisle. And there's a small inset photo here. It's bright green. It looks like a plant leaf. I'm unable to identify it. On top of which sits a bug, an insect, in rather charming colors of olive drab and orange. It is not captioned. I am unable to identify it as a cicada, although that's the topic of the little article. Beehive buzz at the 2004 Grammys. Now, these are information bits dating to 2004. Beyoncé won her first solo Grammy Award for her debut solo album, Dangerously in Love. As of the 2021 awards, held March 14, she's accrued 28 trophies, becoming the most decorated female artist in Grammy history. Old Friends, May 6, 2004, NBC aired the Season 10 Friends finale, with over 52 million viewers tuned in. Executives confirmed April 10 that the original cast has finished filming a reunion special that will air on HBO Max later this year. Space Taxis. In a major milestone for space travel, the first privately crewed space flight was completed June 21, 2004. Today, the private company SpaceX is sending its shuttles to the International Space Station, with four astronauts arriving April 24. The brief milestones. Died. The 53-person crew of an Indonesian Navy submarine that sank off the coast of Bali, according to an official statement April 25. Idriss Deby, president of Chad, at 68 from injuries he sustained while fighting with rebels, state TV said April 20. Former U.S. Vice President Walter Mondale, who served under President Jimmy Carter, April 19. At 93. 1WON. The 2021 Best Director Oscar, April 25, by Nomadland director Chloe Zhao, CHAO, the first woman of color and the second woman in history to win the award. Apologized Mary Lou McDonald, current leader of Sinn Féin, the Irish Nationalist Party, with links to the Irish Republican Army, April 18, for the 1979 assassination of Lord Mountbatten, uncle of the late Prince Philip. Sentenced British-Iranian non-profit worker Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe, who was first detained in Iran in 2016, to an additional year in prison April 26, after being found guilty of propaganda against the regime. She denied the charges. Reported, a newly developed malaria vaccine that showed 77% efficacy in recent trials in Africa, per a preprint study published April 20 in what could be a major medical breakthrough. Died, and this is a slightly longer article written by Katie Lang. An inset photo here is of a gentleman standing on a stage or in a prominent space under lighting. He's in front of a gray background that almost looks like a cloudy sky. He's wearing a black suit. He has black hair, black-rimmed glasses, and he's smiling at the camera. The heading is Died, Alber Elbaz, E-L-B-A-Z, Beloved Couturier. Well, fashion designer Alber Elbaz was perhaps best known for his 14-year tenure as the creative director of L'Avant, his legacy is better defined by the warm generosity of his spirit, embodied in both his exquisite designs and his exuberant personality. Elbaz, who died April 24 at 59 from the coronavirus, began his fashion career working for U.S. designer Jeffrey Bean. He was later tapped for lead gigs at French labels Guy LaRoche and Yves Saint Laurent before taking the helm at L'Avant in 2001, revitalizing the fashion house to both critical and popular acclaim. The through line in Elbaz's designs was a deeply compassionate understanding of what women really wanted from fashion, beautiful yet practical clothing that could make every day feel a little more special. And that compassion resonated in an industry not always known for its empathy. Elbaz was widely beloved for his gentle joie de vivre and kind gestures. He had a penchant for hand-illustrated notes and for sending his fellow designers flowers ahead of their shows. In both design and life, Elbaz led with love. And the final installment on this page died. Michael Collins made giant leaps for mankind. This short article is by Jeffrey Kluger. It has a black and white photo here of a man in a space helmet. Michael Collins became famous for the simple act of not walking on the moon. Collins, who died of cancer April 28 at 90, is best remembered as Apollo 11's command module pilot, in some ways the unluckiest man on the luckiest mission of all time. It was Apollo 11 that in the summer of 1969 stuck the first crewed lunar landing, taking Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin down to the surface, while Collins remained in orbit 60 miles above. Not just an extraordinary pilot and astronaut, he went to space once before Apollo 11, aboard the 1966 Gemini 10 flight, when he became the first person to walk in space twice. Collins was also a reflective, poetic man, a withered, sun-seared peach pit, was how he described the lunar surface in his 1974 autobiography, Carrying the Fire. It was that reflectiveness, that lyricism, that long view of his mission and all of the Apollo missions that made him best suited for his supernumerary role on Apollo 11. As Armstrong and Aldrin cast off in the lunar module, he offered them a casual goodbye. You cats take it easy. And in the interval he spent aloft, alone in his command module, he quietly did his job, ensuring his compatriots would have a spacecraft to return to. I'd be a liar or a fool if I said I had the best seat on Apollo 11, he told Time in a 2019 interview, but I can say absolutely, with total honesty, I was delighted to have the seat I had. Michael Collins served and flew and thrived and wrote and left his rich, nearly musical voice behind. That is more than enough. The Brief, Health. Should we wear masks after the virus is gone? By Jamie Ducharme. As what normally would have been cold and flu season in the Northern Hemisphere draws to a close, many lucky people are having the same realization. They have not been sick since the pandemic started. Federal data show that flu season was extremely mild this year. About 600 flu deaths had been recorded in the U.S. as of April 26, compared with at least 24,000 last flu season. There are a few reasons for that. Flu vaccination rates were high this season. Social distancing kept people away from strangers' germs. And mask wearing in public to help slow the spread of COVID-19 likely limited influenza transmission, too. Masks are only one piece of that puzzle, but the impressive results do raise the question. Should masks stay after COVID-19 is gone? Some experts say yes, masks are minimally invasive, safe, cheap, effective tools that could help reduce the spread of respiratory disease, says Raina McIntyre, a professor at Australia's University of New South Wales, who studies the efficacy of face masks. Where masks were mandated in the U.S., the rates of COVID-19 cases and deaths slowed within 20 days, according to research from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. During a pandemic, masks are useful because they help with source control. They prevent people from exhaling potentially infectious particles into others' airspace, ideally cutting down on the amount of virus that can spread within a community. Because COVID-19 can be spread by people who are not showing symptoms, everyone needs to wear one in areas where the virus is known to be afoot. But Dr. John Conley, an infectious disease physician at Canada's University of Calgary, questions whether masking will be necessary once COVID-19 is better contained. A November 2020 research review co-authored by Conley found that masks did not make a huge difference in protecting the wearer from catching flu-like illnesses. That is not shocking. Experts have long known that cloth and surgical masks are better for source control than for filtering out pathogens that could infect the wearer. Conley considers that an argument against wearing masks during non-pandemic times when there's less dangerous disease spreading through the community and, therefore, less need for source control. And there are downsides to masking, like stunted communication, accessibility concerns for the deaf community, acne, and even trace microplastic inhalation with long-term wear. It is also not clear how long-term masking would affect disease patterns in the U.S., says Dr. Richard Malley, an infectious disease physician at Boston Children's Hospital. If lots of people consistently wore masks, viruses could feasibly spread at low levels all year long, rather than during intense but contained seasons. Permanent masking could even affect human immunity, which builds up in response to pathogen exposures. Once we are not living with the constant threat of COVID-19, Conley says, masks' drawbacks and unknowns would likely outweigh their positives. But there may be an argument for a hybrid approach. Even if masks are not worn 24/7, McIntyre says, mask wearing is easy and safe enough to recommend it in high infection settings like public transit, long-term care facilities, and hospitals. People in many Asian countries used masks before the pandemic, and Westerners could do the same. But masks turned into political symbols in the U.S. during the pandemic. Given the thrum of anti-mask sentiment and the mixed messaging from officials about whether they are effective and necessary, it is unlikely that many people in the U.S. would be willing to wear them after the COVID-19 era, Malley says. Already, many states have repealed or softened mask mandates prematurely, many experts argue. Like COVID-19 itself, masks probably will not be our constant reality forever, but they may not fade away completely either. And even if masking does not stick, there are other pandemic-related public health lessons that may catch on. Never before have Americans been so attuned to how diseases spread and what can be done to stop them. Malley says he hopes that consciousness and conscientiousness will outlast the pandemic. Lessons doctors have preached for years, he says, may finally sink in. Here are four entries from Time's May Books recommendations. While Justice Sleeps by Stacey Abrams. The Georgia politician and voting rights activist has written 8 romance novels under a pseudonym, but she is publishing her newest book, a thriller, under her own name. This legal suspense novel follows a young law clerk who, much to her surprise, becomes the legal guardian of a Supreme Court justice after he falls into a coma. As the protagonist finds herself in an unexpected and powerful position, she must navigate the chaos of Washington politics. The Window Seat by Aminata Forna. In Forna's first book of nonfiction since her 2002 memoir, The Devil That Danced on the Water, the novelist ruminates on experiences throughout her life to tackle questions surrounding identity and belonging. The pieces in her new collection range in subject and scope, from shadowing the lone veterinarian in Sierra Leone to drawing connections between Barack Obama's life and her father's to describing her experience walking all over the world as a black woman. The result is a moving examination of places and people, filled with Forna's carefully constructed observations and analysis. My Remarkable Journey by Katherine Johnson. In her posthumously published memoir, The Mathematician, who died in 2020, details her life and all that she endured, from growing up as a child prodigy in the segregated schools of West Virginia to her rise at NASA, where her research helped land a man on the moon. Though My Remarkable Journey focuses on the life of Johnson, who was also a subject of Margot Lee Shetterly's Hidden Figures, it also pays tribute to the educators who supported her in following her dreams. Heaven by Miyako Kawakami. The protagonist of Kawakami's newly translated novel is shoved into lockers and mocked at school for his lazy eye. His only respite is an unexpected friendship with another student who is also a victim of bullying. But how can a relationship really last when its foundation is built on shared experiences of humiliation? The author moves toward an answer in this quietly devastating tale of middle school drama. Time off music. Here's a page entitled Country Music Reimagined by Andrew R. Chow. A lot has changed in the country music in the decade since the Pistol Annies, a country supergroup consisting of Miranda Lambert, Ashley Monroe, and Angelina Presley, released their first album in 2011. Bro Country swept the airwaves, followed by Country Gentlemen. Traditionalists brought back fiddles and lap steel guitars. Innovators fused the genre with pop, R&B, EDM, and rap, R-A-P. But one thing has not changed. Women are still barely played on country radio. In 2015, radio consultant Keith Hill called women the tomatoes sprinkled into the male lettuce of country radio salad. A 2020 study showed that 1 in 10 songs on Billboard's 2019 year-end airplay chart was by a woman. While the Pistol Annies have put out 3 stellar albums, none of their songs has climbed higher than number 40 on the Billboard country airplay charts. Lambert on her own has churned out hit after hit, but she is a rare outlier in the genre. Maybe it's unsurprising, then, that the women of country would find more success elsewhere, particularly on streaming platforms. This spring, two-thirds of the Pistol Annies return with albums that seem barely in conversation with mainstream country radio at all. Lambert's The Marfa Tapes, May 7, is an acoustic trio record with the veteran songwriters John Randall and Jack Ingram that sounds like it was recorded through a tin can. Monroe's Rose Gold, April 30, has a lot more in common with the reverb-drenched indie pop of the moment. But the two records are thrilling, precisely because of their nonconformity. They showcase artists who have long reveled in their rebel status, chasing creativity on their own terms. The Marfa Tapes is the stronger and more startling of the pair. Since 2005, Lambert has cheerfully embraced the slick richness of Nashville's sound, while also pushing the bounds of its lyrical chasteness. For this album, in the midst of quarantine, she abandoned the studio for a house in the Texas desert. You can hear planes hum overhead and cans crack open as the trio's haggard setup lays bare their emotional bond and musical mind meld. The melodies are so evocative you might mistake them for long-lost campfire classics. They practically beg to be covered, whether by buskers or bedroom artists on TikTok. Given Lambert's stature, the album feels potentially transformative, a cultural reset on the level of acoustic masterpieces like Willie Nelson's Red-Headed Stranger or Bruce Springsteen's Nebraska. Monroe runs in the opposite direction. The Tennessean has garnered critical acclaim for her disarmingly personal storytelling and exquisite production, and Rose Gold takes her exploratory impulses even further. There are plenty of touch points here. Siren spills out with the clipped cadences and guitar overdrive of a Perfume Genius song, while Gold has the bleached strings and California worship of Lana Del Rey. Monroe has laced references to downers into her lyricism, including her classic Pistol Annies line, "I picked a good day for a recreational Percocet," and this project operates under a blissful psychedelic haze. While Rose Gold is an unlikely project to come out of Nashville, it extends a broader, recent trend of prominent female country musicians, from Kacey Musgraves to Maren Morris, exploring their artistry across genre. Of course, the center of country music remains robust, with the radio dominated by affable men singing odes to heartbreak, beer, and small towns. But in this new streaming era, country artists are less beholden to the Nashville establishment than a group like the Chicks, nay, Dixie, nearly 20 years ago. Lambert's and Monroe's vastly different new projects, as well as those of their younger peers, reveal how the spirit of the Pistol Annies, of raw honesty, creative independence, and solidarity, continues to disrupt country's uniformity and lead to vital, groundbreaking work. Here are some excerpts from Time's broader coverage of Time 100 companies. There are dolls pictured here on this page. They look like Barbie dolls, but they're eclectic, they're diverse, they've got curly wigs and big sunglasses and long dreadlocks and clunky wedgies with platform heels and cowboy boots or astronaut boots. And one large hand is held over the top of one of the doll's wigs. Mattel toying with a media empire. Pandemic boredom has been good for Mattel, the company behind some of the world's most iconic toy brands, including Barbie and Hot Wheels. Its 2020 online sales were up 50% as dolls, games, and puzzles flew off virtual shelves. Even so, CEO Enon Kreitz no longer sees Mattel as a toy manufacturing company. Instead, he says, what they do is IP, with dozens of film and TV projects in development and production in partnership with major entertainment companies and big-name actors. Think a Barbie movie, co-written by Greta Gerwig and Noah Baumbach and starring Margot Robbie and Uno and Whac-A-Mole game shows. The opportunity for us is to expand beyond the toy aisle, Kreitz tells Time. That short item was written by Rebecca Katzman. English Premier League. Broadcasting wins. This is by Sean Gregory. The most popular sports league on the planet in the world's most popular sport is the English Premier League, EPL. Led by Chief Executive Richard Masters, the EPL is projected to amass $6.2 billion in revenue this season, according to Deloitte, and pre-pandemic revenues were up 16% over two seasons. International TV deals have offered a source of growth. Such riches have allowed the EPL, now broadcast in 190 countries, to attract the world's best talent. More than 100 EPL players suited up in the last World Cup. More recently, the EPL helped lead the opposition to the European Super League proposal, which fizzled after six of the league's top teams backed out. Sean Gregory wrote that. Worldwide Technology, moving businesses to the cloud. Behind the scenes, Worldwide Technology, WWT, helped power the transition to working from home. Teaming up with manufacturers such as Cisco and Dell, the technology service Behemoth helps a broad range of organizations, including major hospitals and the Department of Defense, select and install computer systems and other digital infrastructure. In 2020, to deal with the surge in demand as companies rush to move to the cloud, WWT hired more than 600 additional employees. Revenues for the company, the largest black-owned business in the U.S., increased 12.4% to $13.4 billion last year. Written by Eben Shapiro, who also writes Home Depot Improving Home Improvement. Sales at Home Depot, the Atlanta-based home improvement giant, grew an astonishing 20% last year to $132.1 billion as consumers hunkered down and spruced up their living areas. Best sellers included appliances, vinyl plank, flooring, and vanities. Some lockdown initiatives will continue post-pandemic. In moving its how-to workshops online, Home Depot expanded their reach and number. An average of 5 in-store workshops a month became 40 live stream workshops a month. In 2021, the retailer plans to continue to invest in its supply chain with a goal of providing same or next day shipping to 90% of the U.S. population. Nubank, Banking the Unbanked, by Ciara Nugent. Brazil's banking system has long faced criticisms of poor service, long wait times, labyrinthine bureaucracy, and high fees. This, along with the prevalence of informal work, helps explain why some 45 million of Brazil's 210 million people do not have a bank account, making it almost impossible for them to access credit or a means of saving. Nubank, N-U-B-A-N-K, Latin America's largest fintech company, is helping millions jump barriers by offering a variety of financial services via its smartphone app. Since the pandemic began, Nubank's customer base in Brazil has more than doubled to 35 million as people avoided travel to crowded banks. CVS administering vaccines by Jamie Ducharme. Pre-pandemic, stopping into CVS was often just another errand on a to-do list. But these days, that trip could be the most anticipated event of the year. The pharmacy chain, led by CEO Karen Lynch, has become one of the top U.S. COVID-19 vaccine administrators, with more than 10 million doses given as of April 1, topping the total number of vaccines given by all but four states as of April 19. Shots are available in nearly 2,000 CVS locations across the country, and the pharmacy has also brought vaccines into long-term care facilities nationwide. Here's the introduction to Time 100's most influential companies. Which companies are shaping our future? The question at the heart of our first ever Time 100 Most Influential Companies is a new list and an expansion of our iconic Time 100 franchise that highlights businesses making an extraordinary impact around the world. To assemble it, Time solicited nominations across sectors, including healthcare, entertainment, transportation, technology, and more from our global network of editors and correspondents, as well as from industry experts. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.